This is your Real Estate Syndication Show. I'm your host, Whitney Sewell. Today, I have a very special guest for you. And before we jump into the guest, I have a special announcement as well. You may have already heard we're changing the cadence of the podcast from daily to weekly, really in an effort to serve you better. We want to have bigger name guests on more often and to be able to produce higher quality content for you, and which we are starting with today. Our guest today is a co-founder and CEO of 75 and Sunny Ventures. He's also co-founder and chairman of Picasso and a number of other very successful startups. He's also the founder of Zillow and was CEO of Zillow for 15 years. You're going to hear him talk about a number of things around Zillow and his time there today during this interview. His name is Spencer Raskoff. During his time as CEO of Zillow, he won dozens of Best in Places to Work awards and grew to over 4,500 employees, $3 billion in revenue, and $10 billion in market capitalization. And you're going to hear a number of things come from those experiences today. But, you know, and while he has, just an amazing bio and achievements, and he's been on CNBC and New York Times and bestselling author, all these things, you know, one thing I really enjoyed about the interview with Spencer is his focus on family. And we talked about that a lot. And we jumped into how he manages that dynamic and how he did when things were so busy and what is that filter to say no. And you're going to hear his focus on family, which I really appreciated, which you all know. And I hope that you are doing that as well. You're going to hear also his view on the economy and what he expects through the end of this year and what he's doing, and even how passive investors should be navigating the economy today. You're going to hear that and even some things that he's invested in and things he's not invested in as well, which may surprise you today on the Real Estate Syndication Show. Spencer, welcome to the show. I'm honored to have you on and to meet you, and really and for you to be our 2000th guest. So thank you again.
Thank you. Thanks for having me, and congratulations on the longevity of this podcast. I've done a couple podcasts of my own. I think I got to about 100 something episodes in one and 75 in another. 2000 is next level. So congratulations, and to the listeners, thank you for sticking around and congrats on 2000 episodes. It's really quite an accomplishment.
I appreciate that in a big way. And you know, Spencer, I want to begin with a different topic, I think, than most. I've listened to many interviews that you've done over the last few days, or actually that you've recorded over the last few years, probably, and learned a lot about you. And something that resonates deep with our audience and with me personally is really this balancing this dynamic between the being that CEO and pushing this professional, you know, success, right? But also, man, being famous at home, right, as well. And so, you know, I just wonder, you know, how you have managed that well, because it's often not done well. And I speak at conferences and I hear people talk about, man, you know, just going and conquering and doing all these things in business, but there's not much talked about, you know, about how they still are famous at home and do that well. So how have you done that or balanced that well?
Well, so I've been with my wife since we were 17. We started dating right before college and dated all through college. And, you know, we're now 40, 49. So we've been together a long time. So when you're with somebody from the beginning, there's a certain humility. So, I can win business awards, or I can be on TV, or I can achieve business accolades. And at the end of the day, my wife still sort of, and I mean this in a loving, great way, she still treats me like the idiot 17-year-old that she fell in love with. So, there's really no impressing her with any great business accomplishments. And the result of that is it keeps me humble. It's like whenever I think I might have achieved any great business success, it's like, no, you know, you're just Spencer. So, I think the way I, behave at home is just to try to be a great dad and a great husband. And I'm really, you know, it can be a bit of adjustment, especially when I was managing very large teams at Zillow. So I would have, you know, teams of handlers and PR people and, you know, multiple assistants. And then the, you know, the sort of home life is very different than that. But to me, that sort of keeps me grounded. And I think it's been a recipe for great home life happiness and a successful marriage and a successful home life. You know, the only other thing I'd flag on this is how things have changed now that most of us are working from home. You know, it looks like you're probably, that looks like kind of a residential background. I'm guessing you work from home. I work from home now.
I do.
And that's quite different. You know, on the one hand, it's nice. I've got kids at home still and they get to see me work and they get to understand my work ethic. It's no longer sort of out of sight, out of mind, where when I used to go to an office and they wouldn't really think about it. I think now they've got a better conception of what it is that I do and the fact, you know, and I think it's valuable for them to see literally out of the corner of their eye, me working. But it can also be hard to create boundaries. It can be hard to turn off work. You know, it used to be a lot easier when I went to an office. At the end of the day, I'd come home and I would leave my cell phone with my car keys and not look at it for a couple of hours and work was done. And now I was home. Well, nowadays, obviously, we don't have those clear boundaries. So that can be difficult. And I encourage people to try to find ways to create those boundaries for their own mental health and also for the success of their family life.
Yeah. You know, are there filters maybe that you have, you know, where, you know, when to say no to something, because oftentimes, you know, maybe there's, I was even invited recently to speak at a very large conference and I've been at, you know, there many times, but most people say, hey, you're crazy not to go take advantage of this opportunity. But there's some things in the family side that, hey, I knew that I wanted to be there for those things. So I just said, you know, I'm going to have to say no to that thing, you know, but you know, that's difficult or there's a tension there, but is there filters that, you know, you've used to say, you know what? As amazing as this opportunity may seem, I'm just going to say no to it this time. It allows you to say yes to something else, right?
I do it all the time. And you know, I mean, what I'm doing today in 2024 is investing in startups and starting new companies and coaching and advising and counseling. And so there are a number of jobs that I have today where I charge rates for my time. So I think that's been a very helpful construct because it helps me make decisions about certain things. You know, it's like, do I want to, like, how much is that thing, even if I'm not getting paid for something, how much is that worth it to me? I think actually I would encourage everybody to start thinking about an hourly rate for their time. You know, even if you don't get compensated that way, just as a benchmark to assess certain things. And then the second thing I would suggest is once you've created that, then you want to be careful not to fall into that trap, because let's say your hourly benchmark is $1,000 an hour. That's kind of what you get compensated for, $500 an hour, whatever, you know, whatever the number is. Now you're like, okay, do I want to go to that kid's volleyball game or should I work for those 2 hours? Well, that's 2 hours, $500 an hour. That's $1,000. Okay. Would I pay $1,000 to go to the volleyball game or would I work for that? And the problem with that construct, even though I do think it's helpful to have kind of on the proverbial whiteboard. The problem is, that time is fleeting. And I've observed this as my kids are older now. My kids are 18, 15, and 12. And, you know, a volleyball game or a soccer game or a kid's performance that I perhaps might have missed 5 years ago, like I would absolutely pay that $1,000 today to go back in time and experience that, especially now that kids are older and they need me less, want me less. And, you know, and I can now work more. So, it's like, time is money, but also the exchange rate of the currency is changing over time. If you're a great parent and as kids get older, that exchange rate changes as your kids need you less and want you less. So that's another important thing to keep in mind.
I love that thought process. Not so much would I pay $1,000 to be there today, but would I pay that 10 years from now to be there today, ultimately at that game?
There's a great book, Whitney, that I recommend called Die with Zero, which has a very provocative title, but you know what it argues is that we delay gratification too much. We aspire to accumulate wealth too much, and we, you know, that like, for example, I'll get that ski house later when I have more time and money. It's like, okay, well, what, you're going to wait till your 50s or 60s and or 70s and you can't really ski anymore because your knees don't work? Or, you know, I'll wait to go on that safari with my family until I have more money. It's like, okay, but if you wait too long, your kids don't want to go on that safari with you anymore because they have their own lives and they don't think you're cool anymore. So, like, the book argues, and I subscribe to this this philosophy, that you want to maximize life experiences and be really cognizant and intentional about how to achieve those experiences at the right times, because if you just wait, it'll be too late. You know, you'll have plenty of money, but you'll be 80 and no longer able to enjoy or experience the fruits of those labors.
Yeah, I think it's a great point. That book prompted me to take my mother on a trip.
You read it?
Yeah.
Oh, cool.
Yeah,
I don't usually encounter people that read it. Oh, that's amazing that I've read it.
Yeah, so cool. We took my mother on a trip and my sister and her family as well. And that prompted that because it made me think about, well, wait a minute, you know, 10 years from now, she's not going to be able to go on a trip like that. Either.
That's awesome. Know? That's exactly. Yes. Good. That's amazing. That is exactly what the book argues. And I'm so glad that it's had an impact on you as well.
Yeah. One other question on this topic, any family rhythms that you found just to help you to cultivate those relationships, you know, whether, you know, as a husband as a father or anything, maybe, you know what, I made sure that I had this on the calendar every month, or maybe it's a date night or something like that.
The thing that comes to mind is kid trips alone. So I have three kids. We have a very close-knit family, but a trip with the five of us is very different than a trip with me with one of my kids. So my wife and I try very hard, and we usually achieve it, to each of us do at least one trip with just one kid each year. And I'm planning the ones right now. I'm taking my older daughter to Europe for a couple of days. I'm going to go to Colorado with my middle, and I'm going to go to, I think, Wyoming with my youngest. So just even, you know, 2, 3, 4 days alone, parent child, I think is really important.
Yeah, love that. Well, you know, I've heard you mention in some other interviews about this career mirror. Right. And, you know, someone that reflects back to you the reality, you know, right, of your growth and journey. Could you just, I guess, share a little bit about what that is for our listeners and maybe how this has helped shape your decisions? And
absolutely. Absolutely. So every major career decision that I've made has been impacted, really, really catalyzed by my wife, who I think of as a career mirror, meaning that she's close enough to me to see things that I wouldn't see, but she also has a little bit of distance from my day-to-day work. So telling me that I'm unhappy at a job, or even before I realize that I am, or telling me that I want to be doing something different professionally, even before I realize that I should be, you know, thinking about new challenges, like, that's the role that she has played. And I think it's very important for people to have somebody like that in their life. It can be a spouse, a friend, a parent, a coach, a priest. It can be anyone in your life. But I think that is invaluable. And, when I left Goldman Sachs to go to private equity, she catalyzed that. When I left private equity to do a startup, she catalyzed that. When I sold my first startup and she said I was unhappy at the big company that we had sold our startup to, she catalyzed that. So, it's been really invaluable in my career. And I wish everybody would have something like that in their life.
Can you speak to how does that, I guess, occur? Or is it like when there's a big event that happens and then you all kind of come together to reflect about the situation?
No, it's more organic. At least in my case, it's been more organic. And it, again, it could be because she's assertive. You know, she'll just tell me like, hey, you know, you I don't know. I'm not sure if you're aware of this, but you don't seem as motivated or fired up as you were a year ago when you were doing something slightly different. Like, let's talk about what you should be doing going forward. So it could be introduced by a particular life event, but at least in my cases, it was just her own assertiveness. And the problem is that people are busy, and you know, if you have your head down and you're just sort of plodding ahead, getting to the next performance review, getting to the next vesting date, getting to the next 100th episode of a podcast, you know, you may not pick your head up and say, hold on, wait a minute. Like, does this still make sense? Do I still want to be doing this? Is this still the best use of my time? And so that's where a third party can be really valuable to stick their nose in and say, hold on, wait a minute, time out.
Love that. And is that, say, different, this career mirror, is that, you know, and it's your wife, is that different, say, than, or how you would treat other mentors, you know, the people that influence you like that?
Well, most of those other folks you're trying to impress either intentionally or subconsciously. So it can be difficult for a mentor to play that role. It's not impossible, but frequently a mentor is at your own company or they're in your professional orbit. So in my experience, it's been advantageous for the person to be kind of, you know, halfway in, halfway out, in, you know, in my case, a spouse. So, I mean, she's in my life, obviously, but she's not in my day-to-day professional life. I think it would be harder if it were somebody that were in your day-to-day professional life. But, you know, again, the most important thing is just that there's somebody there to, you know, to press the pause button and prompt you to evaluate where you're going and where you've been.
Yeah, no, that's very helpful to think about the difference in your spouse. Hopefully you're able to receive feedback from your spouse, right? Mine has also been so crucial in so many decisions made, even in business. Even though she's not in business, she has said things that have just been helped me to change or pivot that's been so instrumental that I wouldn't have expected even, right? And I've grown to like expect it, like ask her questions knowing that she's going to speak into these decisions that are so important. So, you know, changing gears again, Spencer, a little bit, you know, and even thinking about how we're, I know you have a desire to continually learn, right? And this continuous learning, and it's something that I've grown in over the last number of years. Wasn't taught that really young, unfortunately, but I've grown to, man, know just, hey, I want to read, want to learn. Just wondered, you know, as busy as you are, you know, in your schedule and over the last many years, do you have a method for that? You know, how do you take in content or good quality content so you're continuously learning and growing in personal development?
Well, this is a great question. And I think AI is the perfect litmus test for this because we've all heard about AI over the last 6, 12, 18 months, and it can be pretty intimidating. Right. You're like, okay, I know I need to figure all this stuff out, but you know, am I too old, or like, where do I start? And like, I was talking recently to a startup CEO, tech exec in his mid 50s, who's had incredible success. He started companies, he's taken companies public. He's, you know, he's a really great tech executive. And he confided to me, he said, you know, I'm just like, on this whole AI thing, I'm kind of throwing my hands up. Like, I know it's important. I know it's going to change the world, but I just, you know, I just don't really want to jump in and figure it all out the way 5, 10, 20 years ago, I did jump in and figure out cloud or mobile or search engine optimization or whatever another arising tech change was at the time. And, you know, and I was like, okay, you know, again, life is short, you know, die with zero, that's totally fine. Then don't. And I'm sure there will be a time when I feel that way about some other future tech development. Maybe it'll be 5 years from now, maybe it'll be 25 years from now. I don't know. But for now, I'm still motivated and interested and curious. To answer your question, the ways that I learn, I like to learn by talking with people. I learn by listening. And so for AI, for example, I try to surround myself with great people that understand these issues better than I do. And I ask a lot of questions of them, almost in a Socratic way, where, you know, in an ancient Greek pupil would ask questions of his tutor to learn a topic. And you're supplementing that with book learning, with reading. But the ancient Greek way of education was very much more of a one-on-one tutelage verbal method of education. So talking with lots of people and then tinkering myself. So, you know, I'll ask some of my AI friends, like, you know, what are a couple great tools that I should play with? Okay. You know, Hey Gen is a very cool tool that helps create AI generated videos. So I checked it out. I downloaded it. I got a subscription for a month. I created a bunch of videos of myself using AI and then my kids using AI, and I got it. And then I canceled the subscription. Like, I get it. I can move on and go try to tinker with and play with the next, you know, the next set of tools that are recommended to me by experts. So that's how I learn.
Yeah, love that. You know, you talked about the one-on-one and asking questions. Sounds like a good podcast, actually.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, that's, I mean, I mentioned I had two podcasts. One of my podcasts was Dad, I Have a Question, which is how I taught my son. So my son was, I guess he's 15 now, but we did the podcast from about age 10 to age 13. And he would ask me a question, you know, Dad, what is crypto? What is blockchain? What is inflation? How do banks make money? What's private equity? What's venture capital, et cetera. And I would teach him the answers to those questions. And then we would discuss it. And then he would play it back to me as he would teach it to a peer of his, to a kid. So it's a great podcast for kids to learn these issues and also for adults to learn about these topics. But that's an instance of me in the, you know, in the teacher role, teaching a younger person. But in the case of these emerging technologies, I'm usually the student, not the teacher.
Yeah, I like that. And I've listened to a few of those, and I love it. Oh, cool. That it is, you know, it's taught in a way that a child can understand, right? So I can understand it too.
Yeah, I get a lot of feedback from parents that way that are like, oh yeah, I started listening to it with my kid, but actually, you know.
And I think I heard you say one time that oftentimes those are conversations that come up around the dinner table.
Yeah, I mean, the way the whole podcast started was it was organic. I mean, my father-in-law would listen to these conversations, and he was learning, and he would say to my son and me, he'd say, wow, this would make a great podcast. So that's where it came from.
Awesome. You know, another thing you talk a lot about is the founder product fit, you know, and just the importance of that. And, you know, I think it speaks volumes, different things I've heard you talk about around that. And, you know, the way people can be motivated about a product because they are just so ingrained in what it is. But, you know, could you just elaborate on that a little bit and maybe how you assess that fit?
So there's no such thing as just a great founder, in my opinion. There's only a great founder for a particular idea. You know, if you asked me to go start a biotech startup, I would be terrible at that. I'm just not interested in it. I'm not motivated by it. But if you ask me to create a two-sided marketplace that uses information transparency to democratize access to some asset or information that was previously inaccessible to most people, like, that's my jam. You know, I've done that in real estate. I've done that in travel. I'm doing it in real estate again right now. Like, those are the types of things that I'm motivated by. So that's what I'm looking for. I'm looking for a founder who deeply connects with a product or mission or strategy. And the example I like to use is this guy, Garrett Rothstein, who is my co-founder of a startup called Q-U-E-U-E. You know, Q is a streaming discovery app. So it lets you figure out what to watch on TV or what movies to watch based on what your friends are watching. And I remember when he and I were first getting to know each other and we were talking about whether to start this company together, I said to him, I said, Garrett, what would happen if I told you you couldn't do this startup? You know, for whatever reason, you just couldn't pursue this idea. And he just looked at me kind of wide-eyed, and he's like, Spencer, like, you don't understand. I was put on earth to solve this problem. I wake up every morning trying to figure out how to help people figure out what to watch. I go to sleep every night trying to figure it out. Like, this is what I was meant to do. I have to do this. I would do this for free. And that, to me, is founder product fit. That's a founder that connects deeply with the challenge and mission, the problem that that company is trying to solve. And, you know, there are plenty of other people that would not be motivated by that, but Garrett uniquely is. So that's what I'm looking for when investing or when starting companies with people.
What about when the, you know, and I'll use myself as an example. You know, our mission really at LifeBridge Capital is helping families be able to bring their children home to adoption. And so we have a foundation that helps families with financial grants and whatnot, but we fund that through the commercial real estate business. And so obviously we have four children through adoption. And so that's a big passion of ours, is helping these families. So it became the mission behind LifeBridge Capital, right? Awesome. And the commercial real estate business. But it's kind of, you know, it's not, I guess, directly commercial real estate, but it's, that's how we do it. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Amazing. I mean, good for you. That's fantastic. You found a way to harmonize your business with your civic and philanthropic and mission driven goals. So that's awesome.
Have you ever passed on a project maybe that you thought later, hey, I should have been a part of that, but, you know, because it wasn't a good founder fit?
I've passed on many hundreds of companies that I think are good ideas. The founder seems good. The company will probably succeed, but I'm not personally connected to it. I just don't really care very much about that particular topic. And so I'm not the right collaborator or investor for that particular person. A lot of VCs keep a good track of their, what they call their anti-portfolio, kind of the ones that got away.
Yeah.
Because I'm not a real VC, I'm an angel investor. I haven't really done that, because the way I approach investing is much more like coaching. I mean, what I did for 20 something years was I was on the field playing at a professional at a, you know, very high level. And I'm on the sidelines now, and I'm comfortable with that. That's where I want to be, because playing on the field professionally, you get a lot of bruises, and it is, you know, all consuming, and there are a lot of injuries, and it's a lot. And coaching is still intense, but it's a different level of intensity. And I do that coaching and teaching and mentorship in a lot of different ways. I do it by investing in startups. I do it by starting companies with other co-founders, and I do it by teaching at in college and in business schools and doing podcasts. And I get compensated in different ways for that teaching, coaching, mentorship. And sometimes I don't get compensated at all. I just do it, you know, out of interest. Anyway, to answer your question, like, I'm the framework that I use when thinking about investing isn't always monetary. It's frequently, do I think I can be a good coach or mentor to this founder? And would I learn from doing that and spending my time doing that? So it's a little different than a traditional venture capitalist that's just maximizing return.
Yeah, I don't think I've heard anybody phrase it like that before, like approaching investing like coaching. So I love that. You're investing in this founder and their business and hopefully their growth, but yours as well. And you're going to learn from that. I love that. You know, and speaking of just investing, you know, I get questions. I'm sure you get this question a lot more than I do, but like, what's going to happen, right? What's going to happen, you know, over the next 6, 12, 18 months? And I want us to go there a little bit, but, you know, often I say, you know, none of us know exactly, of course, but what we believe is going to happen affects what we're going to do, what we're doing now. Right. And so I just wonder your thoughts of the economy over the next 6, 12, 18 months, anything you're bullish, bearish on, trends, anything like that?
Well, a lot of my companies are in the real estate tech space or the prop tech space, and as is yours. And that's deeply impacted by mortgage rates. And so, I like most people in the real estate industry, have been holding our breath, waiting for the Fed to cut rates this year. And as inflation has stayed stubbornly high, the Fed has been very cautious to start lowering rates, and they haven't started lowering rates. So I think there will still probably be two rate cuts in 2024. Going into 2024, most of the experts thought there would be up to six rate cuts, and that clearly is not going to happen. So what I think will happen is there will be two rate cuts this year, probably in the summer and the beginning of the fall. Then we'll have the presidential election. I hope for a, it's crazy to say this. I can't believe I'm about to say this, but I hope for a peaceful election. Whatever the outcome may be, I have plenty of personal opinions about what I hope the outcome will be. I tend to keep those mostly to myself. But mostly, I hope it is a peaceful out and uncontested outcome on both sides. And we won't know that until probably late November, maybe even into the first quarter, depending upon what happens. So that to me is the wild card. And I think I, like many executives, are going to be kind of in a hold your breath mode from October through January. And remember, the election's in early November. But it's going to be a couple months, a month or two before and a couple months after before we know that it's sort of settled.
It's a good thought. So holding your breath from October, maybe through what, no, November or
Through
January.
inauguration, I guess at least through January 6th.
That's right. That's right.
Not to get too political, but that will be an important date, I think, to get past.
Any advice you would give to passive investors today, just navigating the current climate in the things that you've mentioned?
I was lucky enough to be on the board of trustees of my high school and my kids' high school with Charlie Munger for many years. And Charlie was on the board for 55 years, I think. I've been on that board for maybe 7 or 8. And so we overlapped for the last 7 or 8 until he passed away. So I learned a lot from Charlie. And I think the most important thing I learned from Charlie is the importance of patience in investing. And the power of compounding and the importance of buying great businesses at good prices. But when I say buying, that includes investing in. The world that we live in today is very minute to minute itchy, like a itchy trigger finger. I think that's the expression. But the media, the social media, but also business TV encourages this kind of fast twitch reaction to everything political, everything business, everything economic. And that's a terrible way to invest. There's a great, I remember a friend of mine at Goldman Sachs once showed me a really interesting analysis, which looked at stock price appreciation over the last like 30 or 40 years. Across different indices. And the point that the slide made was that it is impossible to time anything. If you're like, oh, the market's hot, I'm gonna sell, and then I'll come back in when it cools down. That I forget exactly what the data said, but it was something to the effect of, if you were out of the market on just, I think it was like 12 days over the last 30 years, your rate of return would have been, I don't know, 30% lower or something than if you had just stayed in it and buckled your seatbelt. In other words, none of us have any idea. Timing things is impossible. Try to keep fees low and enjoy the benefits of compounding and buy good businesses at decent prices, and then try not to overly obsess about it day to day.
Yeah, love the focus on patience, for sure. If I heard correctly, I think that you don't own any real estate directly, right?
I don't. I mean, I have a couple of personal homes, and I own a Picasso, which is a portion of a home in Malibu, but I do not own any real estate investments.
Is
No.
there any, I guess, what are your thoughts behind, let's say, not owning real estate directly or, investing in real estate directly?
It's mostly around the complexity and the sort of inaccessibility of the asset class. This is one reason I love Picasso when I started the company, and one reason I invested in another startup called Arrived Homes, which I'm an advisor to. And Arrived Homes lets, I do own some real estate through Arrived. So I created an account with Arrived, and I buy you know, I've bought, I don't know, tens of thousands of dollars of single family rental properties just through Arrive, through their platform. So I don't even remember where they are, or, you know, all I know is I own tiny little pieces of it, and then Arrive does all the property management and they just send me the dividend check. And Picasso is something sort of similar for co-owned vacation homes, but you get to enjoy the home instead of just using it as an investment. So trying to create accessibility for those asset classes is something I'm very interested in. And that's why I've invested in and started those two companies. But it just feels sort of daunting. Like, where would I even start if I wanted to go buy a mini mall or a apartment building or an office complex? Like, I wouldn't even know. I guess I could call a commercial real estate broker. it's illiquid. It seems complex. So those are the reasons why I haven't done it. It's not because of any asset allocation strategy. It's more just the inaccessibility.
Yeah, it sounds like, you're harnessing what you know, right? What you're familiar with, mm-hmm. and startups and businesses and really focusing there versus pivoting into something that maybe you don't feel as comfortable with as that.
That's exactly right. I mean, I'm an investor in over 100 or around 100 startups. And I probably, you know, it's an interesting question. I try not to ask myself this question too much, but if instead of investing in those 100 startups over the last couple of years, I had just put all that money in the S&P 500, or if I had put it into a couple commercial real estate projects or residential real estate projects, you know, what would be the best financial outcome of those three different scenarios? My guess is investing in the startups, which is what I did, probably is the worst of those possible, scenarios. But again, I know this is strange to say, but I'm not necessarily trying to maximize, return on my investment. I'm also doing it out of interest, because that's what I want to do, is I want to spend time with founders that are trying to build cool companies and try to help them any way I can. And that to me is the business model of coaching, the business model of mentoring the types of executives and founders that I want to spend time with is angel investing. So that's why I pursue that business model.
And I think it speaks volumes to you and where you're placing the value, right? You're investing in these people and in a big way, and not just even the founder, but their whole team, right? By getting behind them. I think that speaks as well to how you, I think I heard you mention numerous times that, you know, one of your greatest achievements was the culture at Zillow that was created. Could you elaborate on, I feel like, or, and even before you do, I just feel like that's so important. Is it something that we all kind of think we are doing or trying to do and can't do really well? What was that culture, and how did you all create such a good culture there?
So great people, properly motivated, build great products, which attract huge audience that generate revenue and profit and shareholder value. So it starts with people. And we did this very, very well at Zillow, the 15 years that I ran it. And I think the most important thing to do is to articulate a mission and make sure that people understand how their work connects to that mission. So the mission of Zillow was to turn on the lights, to empower people with access to information, to create information transparency, and help people make smarter decisions. And that's a cool, lofty mission that will get people out of bed in the morning and going to work. The mission of Picasso is to make the dreams of second home ownership more accessible and affordable to more people. That also is a really cool mission, because owning a second home is awesome. And I want that to be accessible to many, many, many tens of millions of more people around the world than it would otherwise be accessible to. And the people at Picasso and the people at Zillow feel really deeply connected to that mission. It's always communicated to them. They understand why they're there and how their work levels up and ladders up to achieving that mission. People also want to feel fairly compensated and then have autonomy provided to them. And this is one reason why I hate the word boss. You know, I never use the word boss. To me, boss is a verb. It means to boss someone around, to tell them what to do. And that's not what a manager should be doing. A manager really shouldn't, I don't even like the word manager, but I'm not, haven't found a good replacement. But I know what they shouldn't be doing, which is bossing their direct report around. So a good manager is somebody that practices servant leadership, somebody that inverts the pyramid, that where the more senior person essentially works for the more junior person. And the more senior person says to the more junior person, how can I help you? How can I clear your roadblocks? What can I do for you to make you more successful at your job? And the junior person says, oh, what I really need is I need feedback on that thing that I sent you 3 days ago. I need you to clear this roadblock by telling your peer that he needs to run his organization differently. Or, you know, I need you to help me close this candidate. And a good one-on-one is one where the senior person is taking notes and the senior person is receiving the to-dos from the junior person. Okay, so I ask you, who works for whom? Well, the more senior person works for the more junior person because the junior person is staffing the senior person with the to-dos. So that is servant leadership. And that's very different from the traditional hierarchical boss culture. So those are the types of things that we try to do well at Zillow. And I think as measured by third parties and as measured by our employee engagement studies, you know, we did a really great job, and that company culture is absolutely what made the company so successful and allowed us to build great products and then achieve a lot of shareholder value.
Love that. There's a couple great books on servant leadership as well. I could not agree with you more. Is there like one or two tips that you would leave with the founder, the CEO that's listening right now that wants to strive to be that servant leader, some way they can implement something even today?
praise in public and criticize in private. And make sure that the mission of the company is well known. And I mean, at Zillow and Picasso, we started every company meeting by reciting the mission in unison. At Picasso, because we're a hybrid company, home-based, every employee has the mission. It's just behind over my shoulder here in the, so we send physical copies to everyone to their home offices. So make sure the mission is well communicated, and make sure that you lead by example by practicing servant leadership.
Spencer, just a few final questions as we just have a few minutes left. Unfortunately, I could talk about a number of these things all day with you, but a lot of people wonder, you know, somebody like yourself, what are some daily habits that you are disciplined about that have produced the highest return for you?
I stay very caught up on email. I don't understand the people that are, you know, let their email inbox get to hundreds or thousands of emails. I basically manage each of my email accounts to inbox zero, and that's an important way I stay organized. I don't have a to-do list. Instead, I use my calendar as my to-do list. So, you know, if I need to write a blog post about something, I'll create a calendar invite to myself for half hour for this afternoon, saying write this blog post, and then I'll have the notes in the, you know, in the notes section of the calendar invite. If this afternoon comes and I don't get around to it, I'll take that calendar invite and send it to tomorrow or next week or next month. So I manage my whole to-do list through my calendar. I am pretty hardcore about flipping my phone to airplane mode when I need to concentrate, or when I'm with my family, or certainly when I'm asleep. To me, if messages are still coming into the phone, even if it's turned, you know, even if it's on vibrate or silent or do not disturb, it still is distracting to me. I still know that life is piling up, and so to me, I switch it to airplane mode as the way to just put the big stop sign and make sure that nothing else comes into it. I exercise regularly. It's very important for mental health and also for longevity. And, those are some personal habits that I have.
Number one thing that's contributed to your success. Just one.
My wife.
And how do you like to give back?
I give back by coaching and mentoring younger versions of me. So people in their 20s and 30s who are building their companies and who I can think who I can help them succeed through my advice and connections. The nonprofits that I'm interested in that I focus my philanthropy on are educational nonprofits and also homelessness here in Los Angeles where I live. So those are my nonprofit focuses.
Awesome. Spencer, grateful for your time, getting to meet you, have you on the show. Very thankful for your transparency and just sharing your experiences. I know there's a number of things that I would love to have gotten to today, but we didn't have time. As you have done so many things successfully and learned so many things too. I wanted to get to the hot wire stuff and even how you scaled so quickly and 200 hiring 200
You can
people.
have me back for your 3,000th
Hey,
episode.
I would love that. I would love
that. Thank you for
Thank
having
you
me.
So much. Well, I hope you enjoyed the interview with Spencer Raskoff. I know I did. I learned a lot from him. I've learned a lot from him already just researching about him. And I hope that you are encouraged that even someone operating at that level can focus on family, can be dedicated in investing as well. And as a CEO, and you can do the same. I know, hopefully you heard in the beginning of the podcast that the Real Estate Syndication Show is transitioning to weekly versus daily, and in an effort to produce higher quality content and to have, you know, a more consistent, bigger name guests on, just like Spencer today. So I hope you enjoyed the show. I hope that you will also share it and subscribe as well. Have a blessed day.